My name is Michael McCusker. I was given something this morning, hot off the PC, from Barbara Darby. And she has a bit of a disclaimer. This is my opinion and my opinion only, with a question mark. I was there yesterday as a large audience, over 100 people gathered to listen quietly as our volunteer county commissioners made historic decisions for our county, the Great Columbia River, and the state of Oregon. Commissioners Scott Lee, Sarah Nebaker, Peter Hutala, Dirk Rohn, and Deborah Berkby first listened to testimony presented in the public hearing by lawyers Mike Connors of Oregon LNG and Lauren Goldberg of Columbia Riverkeeper. The commission then reviewed the records of prior meetings before them and county use law, helped by county planning staff, before crafting a motion and voting unanimously to deny, and that's in all in capital letters, Oregon LNG Pipeline, the right to build a pipeline through Clatsop County, Oregon. The commissioner's motion left LNG the ability to present the county a new application to build their pipeline, should they at some future date be able to comply with all laws, and enumerated these requests as part of their motion to deny the application. In effect, the commissioners worked hard, over 4 hours this time, while only taking 1 5-minute break, in order to put a subject to rest that they have denied before and has drained county resources. The silent audience stood and clapped loudly for the commissioners, who went on with their meeting. And that was by Barbara Darby, an eyewitness to yesterday's Clatsop County Commission meeting. And she says, sort of a P.S., see also today's Daily Astorian, ColumbiaRiverKeeper.org website, and other Oregon news sources. Well, I'd like to more or less devote this program to a single subject. General Vo Nguyen Giap died last week in Hanoi, Vietnam, at the age of 102. He is considered by former friends and enemies alike as one of the greatest military leaders in history. His armies fought for Vietnam's independence against Japan, France, the United States, the Saigon Army in South Vietnam after the U.S. withdrawal, and Vietnam's ancient adversary, China, in that succession, and defeated them all. I would like to read an extract from a biography of Giap, Victory at Any Cost, The Genius of Vietnam's General Vo Nguyen Giap, by Cecil B. Curry, a retired professor of military history at the University of South Florida, who served in the Vietnam War as a U.S. Army chaplain. The book was published in 1997 by Brassey's, Inc., and he wrote the following as an assessment of General Giap. Senior General Vo Nguyen Giap is not a nice person. Neither were more ancient warriors from Attila the Hun and Timur the Lame to Napoleon, Zhukov, Patton, and MacArthur. Nice men do not become legendary generals. They teach Sunday school classes or become professors of history or military chaplains, both of which, of course, the author has been. They do not fill the pages of books with stories of their martial prowess or battlefields with bodies of the dead. Nor can Giap recount tales of his mercy or his love, save perhaps for his relations with family and grandchildren, and even they always occupied a tertiary or quaternary role in his life. Giap reserved his primary affection for his country and his dedication to the Communist Party. He was self-pledged to the liberation of Vietnam from foreign domination and to its unification into one nation. These two goals commanded his attention throughout the decades of his life, and to them he committed his unbridled ambition and hubris. Though he was sufficiently detached emotionally to view lives of subordinates and troops as no more than pawns to be expended without a qualm, his icy exterior overlay a temper so fiery the French described him as a snow-covered volcano. The book I have written was not because of Jop's humanity or personality, although his lack of humanity and the tone of his personality helped to make him what he is, one of the most talented generals of the 20th century and the greatest living expert on people's warfare. His active career as a military commander spanned the years from December 1944 to April 1973, when his protege, Senior General Van Tiendong, replaced him as commander of the army. Even then, Jop remained as Minister of Defense until February 1980, at which time he was dropped from that office in favor of Dung. 36 years of power ended. Even thereafter, until July 1991, a month before his 80th birthday, when he was dropped from membership in the Vietnamese Politburo, he was inevitably a force to be reckoned with in matters military. During that time, he became not only a legend, but perhaps the single greatest military genius of the 20th century and one of the greatest of all time. Not because of his elegance or the brilliance of his strategies. Not because he led and inspired his legions from the front to heights of courage in a few famous battles. Not because of his charismatic persona, nor his undeniable ego. Because of his results. Jop is the only general in modern history to launch battle against his foes from a position of grave weakness, lacking equipment and financial resources, beginning with no troops, yet still able to defeat in succession the remnants of the Japanese Empire, the armies of France, the second-ranking colonial empire, and the United States, one of the world's two superpowers, despite the lengthy and enormous U.S. commitment of energy, resources, manpower, and technology. He went on to oversee battle against the southern Vietnamese, Cambodia, and China. Over more than 30 years, he built a victorious peasant war machine from nothing, and he did so in a poor country, all the while restricted and sometimes wrongly directed by the politics of the Communist Party. He was the driving force behind victory after victory. His record is unparalleled and his results extraordinary. That is military genius. He was not always victorious, as witness his campaigns in 1951 against the French in the Red River Delta area, or his effort against the U.S. Air Cavalry in the Ia Drang Valley in 1965. Yet he was mostly correct in his military insights and judgments. And for a former history teacher without formal military training, that is extraordinary. Like America's George Washington and Nathaniel Greene, he learned war through war. His training, as such, came from whatever he could glean from his reading and what he learned on the job. Books were not that much help in his early efforts. Before fleeing to China at the start of World War II, he went to the main library in Hanoi to see what he could learn. In an encyclopedia, he found a section describing grenades and their detonators. It was very difficult to understand, he later commented. He had in the past fired a shotgun, the single firearm French colons allowed a few influential Vietnamese to possess. The article on grenades and his experience with a shotgun, he said, were, quote, his sole knowledge in the matter of armaments. Jop was bright and imaginative, and he learned on the job rather than at a service academy or in ROTC classes. For him, there were no basic or advanced officer schools, no war colleges, and thus no school solutions, so eagerly sought after by military students so they can get an assignment correct. Jop approached problems without the impediments formerly trained officers often carry with them. In the early years, he had a very flexible approach. Each problem called for fresh answers, which, for a time, he provided. Later, during the years he fought the Americans, his non-dogmatic approach hardened into an official and approved doctrine all its own. In a sense, what at first was highly original later became doctrine. As the war and his forces expanded, Jopp had to teach larger numbers at an ever greater distance. Jopp's strategy in later years was no longer original, except to professionally trained, Eurocentric U.S. officers. For the most part, they looked at his tactics and strategy as cheating, much as their British forebears of two centuries earlier had frowned upon the rebelling colonists of North America. Additionally, like any great commander, Jopp was only as good as his subordinates, for they were the ones who carried out his orders and fought his battles. It is little wonder that Jopp believed in rote training. His army and the Viet Cong operated far from Hanoi at the end of a long line of command and control, communicating with Jopp only by primitive means. He had to trust in their training and believe in their autonomy, for his signals communication was probably closer to that used by 18th century warriors than to those of the 20th. More often than not, it worked. Jopp's challenges made him a master of tactics, logistics, and strategy. He invented a tactical style of warfare that neither France nor the United States was able to overcome. Even Jopp learned how effective it was in the decades after the 7 January 1979 occupation of Phnom Penh in Cambodia by Vietnamese forces, when Pol Pot and his minions faded back into the jungles of Kampuchea and for the next 10 years successfully used Jopp's own tactics against the now more conventionally trained and organized Army of Vietnam. In strategy, he demonstrated the essential requirement to coordinate political purpose with military action. During the Tet Offensive of 1968, for example, television and newspapers brought the war home to Americans, always in dramatic and sometimes in misleading ways. In the middle of a tactical defeat, Jopp breached a gap in the American will to continue through broadcast pictures of a burning C-130 at Khe Sanh, of sappers in the very compound grounds of the U.S. Embassy in Saigon, and of the fighting for the citadel at Hue. That gap found, Jopp pushed through it, crying that he had destroyed, quote, the outmoded belief that modern equipment and a strong force could achieve victory. He put to rest, he said, the myth about the unsurpassable strength of U.S. troops. In logistics, in the early years, he managed time after time to field divisions of fighting men against the French, using a system more primitive than that of Caesar in Gaul. His supply lines resembled those of Hannibal as he and his elephants made their way over the Alps. Marchers wound their way through south over mountains and through jungles, across northern Vietnam, into and through Laos, and down the long miles of Cambodia. Coolie porters carried 70-pound packs up 40-degree slopes while enduring insects, snakes, hunger, occasional attacks from wild animals, fatigue, and tropical diseases. Every step of the 800-mile route they were under threat from American airstrikes. Yet, despite these fearsome difficulties, they delivered hillocks, if not mountains, of supplies. In the earlier years of this effort, every pair of 81-millimeter mortar rounds fired by Jopp's men in the south, for example, represented a 3-month march by one man down the Ho Chi Minh Trail. It was a feat nearly beyond belief. No one was happier than he when, by the mid-1960s, the Ho Chi Minh Trail had been improved to the point that most supplies funneled south along its course were carried by trucks. For this logistics skill, Jopp has received some recognition, but few in the West have been willing to accord him greatness in tactics or strategy. As late as 7 February 1991, he was described at a scholarly meeting in Atlanta as a logistics genius, but only a mediocre tactician and strategist. That is ridiculous. A master tactician would be one who demonstrated an ability to fight and defeat a variety of superior enemies. Jopp did so. From the 1940s to the 1980s, Jopp's armies fought soldiers of Japan, France, the United States, South Vietnam, Kampuchea, and China. He prepared for a long struggle, fought defensively until equilibrium of sorts was reached, and, adapting his approach to his needs, then met his enemies with massive armies capable of defeating them. A master strategist would overcome potential disasters and learn from defeats. Jopp did so. His unfortunate early campaigns against the French taught him how to command and operate an army. His initial contacts with American units gave him the idea for his grab-them-by-the-belt tactics, a way to maximize his own strengths and minimize those of America. Jopp had his setbacks, as at Dien Bien Phu, when his units, savagely attrited, nearly mutinied, and during the dark days when American high-tech weaponry seemed overwhelming. A master strategist would understand his enemies, make use of their weaknesses, and possess a grasp of conflict in its entirety. Jopp did. He understood how important to the final outcome was his primarily social and political hold on the people of the land. They became his unsung warriors. They wore down his enemies, kept them off balance, and supported his main force units in decisive battles. They protracted the French war beyond what Paris could accept, and the American war longer than Washington could afford. He manipulated the collective minds of his enemies by the effects of Dien Bien Phu and Tet 1968. While neither battle was militarily decisive, both were psychologically and critically important on his enemies' home front. Such achievements are the hallmark of a master strategist. Jopp also avoided an essentially military emphasis toward battle adhered to by his two major enemies. Clausewitz would have saluted him. "We hold that our war strategy does not embrace purely military affairs," Jopp wrote. "War must be a comprehensive and combined strategy. The political goals are basic. The army must then not only fight but educate the masses. Thus, all citizen soldiers, all villages and wards are fortresses, and our entire country is a vast battlefield on which the enemy is besieged, attacked, and defeated." He also said, "We focus on one area or another depending on the specific conditions prevailing in each period or stage. This is a very important strategic principle in conducting people's war." Important to the outcome was his belief in his own role. He once drew from his memory a sentence made famous by Napoleon, one of his military heroes, to explain why the Corsican came to head the military efforts of France. Jopp first encountered this quotation when he was still young, still a student, and he was convinced that everything that followed in later years in his own life derived from this one basic principle: "We are here by the will of the people, and we shall never give way." He fought for independence from France and then against the United States and the Republic of Vietnam in a struggle to unify the Viet people under one government. "I belong," Jopp says, "to the generation that grew up during the years following World War I. At that time, my country, very much part of French Indochina, was subject to the infamous policy of the Great Exploitation. These were dark years in the history of my people. By the will of the people, by order of his superior, and by his own determination, he dedicated himself to his goals." His superior, of course, being the person we know as Ho Chi Minh. As the years went by and his victories multiplied, Jopp showed his sure grasp of strategy. Because of his keen imagination and his solid knowledge of the principles of war and the fundamentals of strategy, he regularly outthought his more traditionally trained opponents, even if he did not always outfight them. He was flexible, dogged, and patient. Able to suffer defeats, he tried to learn from them and return to the fray better prepared. As teacher and trainer, he inspired in his peasant troops great trust in his leadership, the courage to resist despite sometimes overpowering odds, and a willingness to sacrifice themselves in their country's cause. In many ways, he was the prime organizer of an entire nation. Jopp mastered the Asian use of evasion and understood how to use the dimensions of time and space in order to count Western dynamic reaction and advanced technologies. He won. His military accomplishments were matched by few in history. And that was from Victory at Any Cost, The Genius of Vietnam's General Vo Nguyen Jopp by Cecil B. Curry. Vo Nguyen Jopp wrote a series of essays in 1967 for two Hanoi publications, Nan Dan and Quan Duy Nan Dan, which were compiled the following year into a book, Big Victory, Great Task, by U.S. and London publisher Frederick A. Prager. Former CBS reporter David Schoenbrunn said in his introduction to Big Victory, Great Task, that General Jopp was a heavy-handed writer whose style was hortatory rather than expository, as though he were haranguing a meeting of communist cadres. The following is an excerpt of one of those essays. Our people are living the most glorious years and months in the history of our thousand-year-old fight against foreign aggression and in that of the decades-old revolutionary struggle under the leadership of our party. In the heroic South, with 170,000 square kilometers of land, they are defeating more than 1 million troops of the U.S. imperialist aggressors and their lackeys and winning bigger and bigger victories. In the North, our army and people are defeating the U.S. imperialist war of destruction and thwarting their basic plot while pursuing basic socialist construction and economic development, consolidating national defense, and fulfilling the duties of the great rear toward the great front line. These glorious victories reflect the mountain-moving and river-filling power of our nation and people. This power is undefeatable. The anti-U.S. National Salvation Program of our party, which is very correct, makes our people and our armed forces invincible. The sympathy and support of brotherly socialist countries and of progressive people all over the world for our people's anti-U.S. salvation cause have grown daily and become increasingly effective. The longer the fight, the more mature our forces and the weaker the enemy forces. Through our anti-U.S. national resistance, all forces of our people have gone through ordeals and become increasingly mature. On the vast front line, through 2 years of direct confrontation with American expeditionary troops, not only have the Southern Army and people scored great achievements, but they have also gained many rich fighting experience. The National Liberation Front, or Viet Cong as we knew them, has become increasingly mature. Its fighting effect and strategic efficiency have been more and more increased, and its offensive impetus has become stronger and stronger. The NLF of South Vietnam has been increasingly consolidated and enlarged as it continuously strengthened the people's political forces. The liberated areas have been enlarged and firmly consolidated. The political struggle movement has been widely developed. The people in the southern cities are rising up to struggle more and more fiercely against the U.S. aggressors and the country selling Vietnam traders. In the North, as the people's armed forces have been developed in quantity, as their quality has been increased, and as they have also learned from the Southern NLF's fighting experiences, their fighting strength has been comprehensively increased. The U.S. imperialists have attacked the North in a very fierce manner, but our people have never been shaken and their determination to fight has constantly been heightened. Our army and people have ever more valiantly engaged in production and combat, are determined to ensure good communications and transportation, and have devoted themselves to supporting the front line. Never before was the friendly and brotherly Northern-Southern love expressed so ardently and deeply as it is now by the 17 million Northern compatriots in their production and combat efforts and in support of the front line. The Northern Army and people fear no sacrifices and hardships and are devoting efforts day and night to fulfilling their task toward the vast front line with the spirit of all for the front line and all for victory. As for the enemy, although his economic and military potential is great, it is, however, obvious that the more he intensifies the war of aggression in Vietnam, the more weakened he becomes and the more difficulties he encounters. Although great, the U.S. military forces have been scattered in many parts of the world. The U.S. imperialists must cope with the National Liberation Movement, with the socialist bloc, with the American people, and with other imperialist countries. The U.S. imperialists cannot mobilize all their forces for the war of aggression in Vietnam. The present mobilization level has far exceeded initial U.S. forecasts and is at sharp variance with U.S. global strategy. At present, the United States does not have enough troops to meet General Westmoreland's requirements. In the days ahead, even if the U.S. imperialists send more forces to the South, they will remain unable to stop the decline of the U.S. expeditionary and puppet troops. The American troops' fighting spirit has declined, and the leadership of the U.S. officers is very poor. Westmoreland remains unable to find any means to help the U.S. imperialists extricate themselves from their deadlock situation and to discover discover any way to help increase the U.S. troops' efficiency and to recover the puppet troops' strength, which has become more and more exhausted. The enemy's weakness stems from his contradictions and his basic weak points, but is also attributable to a decisive factor, the invincible strength and the great achievements of our people. Our maturity stems from the radiantly just cause of the anti-U.S. National Salvation Resistance, the all-people great unity bloc, and the determination to fight and win the correct anti-U.S. National Salvation lines and the strategies and tactics of the undefeatable people's war, the tenacious, indomitable tradition, the potential strength and the fighting experiences of our people encountering foreign aggression, the absolute superiority of the vast rear, the socialist North, and the strong and wide sympathy and support of brotherly socialist countries and progressive people of the world. Facts in the past years have proved that the more we fight, the stronger we become, and the more the enemy fights, the weaker he becomes. This is the law of the protracted, hard, but certainly victorious resistance of our people. The past great achievements are a firm base on which our people can move forward to win final victory. The enemy's heavy setbacks will certainly lead him to complete defeat. At the outset, everything is difficult to do. The anti-U.S. National Salvation Resistance of our people has gone through intense ordeals and initially has defeated the U.S. imperialist limited war strategy. As we have succeeded in overcoming all difficulties at the beginning, we will certainly succeed in overcoming all the forthcoming difficulties and hardships in a more advantageous manner. The recent great achievements are a firm base from which our people can move forward to win final victory. The U.S. imperialists will certainly meet with complete defeat in their war of aggression in Vietnam, because they have encountered a people who not only have a determination to fight and win, but who also know how to fight and defeat all aggressive enemies. The territory of Vietnam is not vast, and its population is not large. Yet the Vietnamese people possess traditions of indomitableness and a very high spirit of self-reliance, and have defeated all aggressive enemies. In the past few decades, our Vietnamese people, relying mainly on their own strength, defeated the Japanese fascists and the French colonialist aggressors, and the U.S. interventionists. Today, our people have defeated the Americans' special war strategy and are defeating more than 1 million U.S. puppet and satellite troops in their limited war strategy. This eloquent fact proves that in the present age, even though a people is small, it can have a determination to unite and fight for independence and freedom in accordance with correct and creative political and military lines, know how to rely mainly on its own strength, how to develop the favorable conditions of the time, and how to launch a people's war in conformity with the characteristics and situation in its own country. Having effective fighting methods, the people are fully capable of defeating and will certainly defeat all aggressive enemies, including the U.S. imperialists. Can a small country, which relies mainly upon its own strength, defeat the limited war of aggression of the American imperialists, the arch-imperialists who possess great military and economic potentials? This is the burning question of our time. The Vietnamese people are replying to this question with their great victories. These victories are the Vietnamese people's great contribution to the world's peoples. History has entrusted this glorious mission to our people, who are resolved to devote all their minds and abilities to totally defeating the U.S. aggressors and thereby to fulfilling this historic task. And that was by General Vo Nguyen Giap and his essay Conclusions Drawn from Anti-U.S. Resistance, and compiled in a book called Big Victory, Great Task. I might also add a proviso that I was a USMC combat correspondent in Vietnam in 1966-67, mostly with infantry, up around the DMZ. And this was during the time General Giap wrote the essays I just quoted from. And he has died at the age of 102 last week. As a matter of fact, I believe it was last Thursday. And I might be back here next Thursday if the debt ceiling doesn't fall on me, which could happen to all of us that very day, October 17th. I am beginning to make comparisons between Tea Partiers and Talibans. They don't seem too dissimilar in the intolerable mischief they perpetrate among their own peoples.